Good afternoon, you are tuned to a Juno afternoon here on the 10th of March, the year 2015. Today on the show, Steve Quinn and Matt Boleyn will be here to highlight this weekend's Phantom Ice Hockey Tournament. We'll find out about this Wednesday's Mudrooms and the home show this weekend. Lucy Potter and Hans Chester will be here to discuss Glacier Valley Elementary's Tlingit Language Program, that Writer's Almanac, Fernote Music, and more today on a Juno afternoon. With the forecast for today, numerous snow showers throughout the day. Forecast for tonight, partly cloudy skies and colder weather, low temperatures 18 to 24 degrees. Forecast for Wednesday, increasing clouds with a chance of snow in the afternoon. Wednesday night, cloudy skies with a chance of snow.
For National Native News, I'm Tristan Ottone, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. The sound of Vegas. That's where people from across the country are gathered to focus on conducting business in Indian country. The National Reservation Economic Summit kicked off Monday. Our Antonia Gonzalez is there and has this report.
Native leaders say businesses on reservations are evolving from gaming to energy to embracing new technology. And with those opportunities, tribes often face challenges. Delaine Enos, who works with the Gila River tribal business, says one challenge he sees is competition in minority-owned businesses.
Just us as natives trying to get ahead, and we get pushed back by the non-natives a lot. It's a competition. You want to be better than the other, but we want to stand out and make ourselves as high as a level as anybody else. Doesn't matter skin color, we want to be up there with everybody else.
Patrick Buffalo from Alberta, Canada, notices issues between tribal politics and business operations.
People get elected into the office. Some of them believe that they're it. Instead of recognizing that we have a business community, we have people that have skills. So it's that foreign model that has really destroyed our people. So we need to go back to the circle model, which is going back to the grassroots level and recognizing that we have people that can contribute to our business initiatives.
Getting funding is one of the toughest problems, says Gerald Fox, who helps manage finances for the Seneca Nation.
We don't have any real ways to get finance through banking institutions and stuff like that, like they do off territories, because you can put up collateral where we can't put up our land and things of that nature and really collateralize. The only way is, unless you've already made a little bit of money to put that aside, you can get banks to work with you and so on and so forth.
A Native business leader who understands many of these challenges is Derek Watchman, board chair of the National Center for American Indian Enterprise Development, which hosts the annual economic summit. Watchman is also CEO of the Navajo Nation Gaming Enterprise. He says learning from other business leaders and finding the right business model are some tools in addressing challenges.
So if you have the capital, if you have the networks, and you have the niche, those are some of the essential ingredients to being successful. And obviously you have to have the drive. You know, you can't do this 8 to 5 to be a business person. It takes a lot of work, a lot of time.
Native professionals and tribal leaders are reaching out to experienced industry leaders, exploring opportunities and networking this week to strengthen their businesses. Sessions include management and access to capital. The Economic Summit runs through Thursday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
March is National Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. According to the American Indian Cancer Foundation, colon cancer affects American Indians at higher rates than other Americans. Mallory Black has more.
Colorectal cancer, or colon cancer, is a disease that develops in the colon or rectum. In the past 20 years, there have been decreases in the number of cancer deaths in the U.S., but American Indians aren't experiencing the same trends. Gastroenterologist David Perdue is a member of the Chickasaw Nation.
Colon cancer is one of these cancers that your risk factors go up if you're overweight, if you have diabetes, if you eat diets that are high in animal fats and, you know, low in fresh fruits and vegetables, you know, if you don't get regular exercise, if you drink heavy or smoke heavy.
Perdue says American Indians also have a fear that the doctor could find something if they get screened. But he says doctors don't want to find cancer. They want to find polyps that could turn into cancer over time. Experts agree annual screenings are one of the best forms of prevention. Last year, the American Cancer Society expected colon cancer would be diagnosed in more than 136,000 people in the U.S. Mallory Black, National Native News.
For National Native News, I'm Tristan Ottone.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Science, technology, engineering, and math students thrive at New Mexico Tech. Personalized instruction, rigorous curricula, undergrad research opportunities. New Mexico Tech, where the smart kids go. Info in Winds of Change magazine or visit nmt.edu. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau and Garinan FM in Juneau here in a Juneau afternoon. First guests are Steve Quinn and Matt Boleyn. We're here to talk about the ice hockey tournament, which is going on this weekend. Matt and Steve, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thank you for having us.
Well, first of all, what is a Bantam League?
So the Bantams, it's technically an under-14 league, so it's 13- and 14-year-olds. Most of them are 8th and 9th graders. There's a couple of 7th graders in there, but 8th and 9th graders for the most part.
And this is a tournament, so we get a lot of out-of-town people.
Yeah, there's 10 teams, 9 of them out of town, and it's the Tier 3 Bantam State Tournament, so the state championship. We're looking forward to it. This group of kids last year finished, most of them finished second place in the age group before the youth 12 division, so they're looking forward to getting their first championship this year.
What do you mean by Tier 3? It's not like Tier 1 where these kids are ready to retire.
Yeah. So the state of Alaska, all USA Hockey, is Tier 1, 2, 3, and 4, and Tier 1 and 2 are higher-level comp associations that travel around in their nationally bound teams, and this is the highest level of non-nationally bound teams and leagues.
You want to give us an overview of the tournament, please?
Sure. Yep. It starts off on Friday morning at 7 a.m. The final game concludes at 9:45. Friday's Juno game at 7 p.m. has a special guest from the governor's office dropping the puck. Saturday, the same schedule, starts off at 7 in the morning and concludes at 9:45 at night. Sunday, the first two games, the first one starts, I think it's at 8 o'clock, is the semifinal games, and then the next, right immediately following that, is the second semifinal game, with the championship game starting at 3 o'clock.
Does it cost to get in?
It costs nothing to get in.
And it's open to the public?
Open to the public.
What other kinds of divisions are there besides Bantams? You mentioned it before.
Yeah, so in the JDIA Youth Association, the first group is Intro to Hockey, and that age group can range pretty widely. It's anyone that's just starting out. Excuse me. And then there's the Mites, and that would be under 8 and under, so 4, 5, 6, 7, 8-year-olds. The next one is Squirts, and that's 10 and under, so mostly 9 and 10-year-olds. And then Peewees, 11 and 12, Bantams, 13 and 14, and then the Midgets are 15, 16, 17, 18.
Is there an age when they start really to get hockey other than just throwing the puck around?
I think for a lot of kids it's around 11, 12 years old. That's when they really start to get it and really develop a love for it.
So how many people are coming to town this weekend?
Roughly, conservative estimates, about 450 people. There's about 150 athletes, and then, figuring on two people per player, so that's another 300. So about 450 people staying at hotels and eating out at restaurants and renting cars, and, roughly, $100,000 is what we've estimated that input into the community.
That's a lot of economic stimulus.
Yeah, absolutely.
Any special rules that go under a Bantam League game?
Well, these kids get to check for the first time. And by checking, I mean they get to knock the opponent off the puck with their shoulders leaning into them, knock them into the boards, into the glass, in the battle for the puck. And the 13- and 14-year-olds, this is their first taste at checking. and they watch the pros do it. They watch the college players do it. They watch the high school players do it. And they've been looking forward to that ingredient of their game. But, you know, these are still 13- and 14-year-olds. They're not college players. They're not the high-level junior players or pro players. They're playing 12-minute periods. They're not playing 20-minute periods. So they're challenged, but they're not playing as much as the higher-level players.
What are the kinds of rules are there that differs that from another league? You mentioned the time.
The time.
And the checking.
The checking. The rules are basically the same. A lot of, you know, it could be come down to an association as far as maybe overtime rules and shootout rules. That could vary from state to state, association to association. But, you know, as you get older, you know, the rules are the same across the board. You're playing the same game that the pros are, as you know, basically, the basics.
How many people are on a team?
20 are on this Bantam team from Juneau. The maximum you can have on a team, on a roster for a travel team, is 20. So, but some will have as few as 10, and as many. And we'll, you know, Juneau, we're going to field a 20-person team. That includes two goalies and 18 who will play either forward or defense.
Matt, you're an assistant varsity coach and also the president of the board for GDIA.
That's correct.
What does it take to get these massive number of people here?
Well, it started off last April at the statewide OSHA meeting, the Alaska State Hockey Association. Different associations put in bids for tournaments, and when the Bantam Tier 3 came around, I raised my hand, and they said, really, you guys want to host a tournament? Because it's been a while. It's been about 7-8 years. So this is our second tournament we've hosted. I said, yeah, we're ready to do it. And all the talk around the room, they were all excited about coming to Juneau and visiting. They've never been to the capital before. So that's when the planning started. It was almost a year ago.
What kind of things do you have to do to make everybody happy?
Oh, yeah. Well, started with our tournament director and our tournament committee. They've been doing all the planning, all the work, the big legwork behind it.
A lot of heavy lifting. A
lot of heavy lifting between, asking for hotels to open up blocks of rooms and working with Alaska Airlines, and Steve was pretty pivotal in securing some grant money for us from Holland America. And the city to allow us to take up an entire weekend worth of ice time at the Treadwell Arena. So huge thanks to CBJ and Parks and Rec. The schedule, the basic scheduling and locker rooms and hospitality rooms, and making sure that everyone has such a great time that they want to come back to Juneau next year for another state tournament.
The teams are coming in early too because they want to see the capital. I think one team has arrived today. Another team is supposed to arrive tomorrow, and they want to see the state capitol, the city itself. They want to spend time in the building. They want to see the legislature at work. It's in-person civics lesson for the 13 and 14-year-olds. And last year, Matt and I were both on the road with different teams. He was with Pee-wees, and he will be again. I was with the Squirts. And each of us heard from parents and coaches and team managers, we'd love to come to Juneau. And so the board decided that when Matt and our coaching director, Arnold Liebelt, went to Anchorage, that we would put in for a tournament. And we got one, and we've been working pretty hard at it ever since. As Matt said, mostly the Bantam committee and the tournament director have done a lot of heavy lifting.
Well, that's a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. Let's go to the times and the days of the tournament, please.
Yeah, so Friday, the first game starts at 7 a.m., and the last one ends at 9:45, so the entire day full of hockey, back-to-back-to-back. Juneau plays its first game at 1:30.
Juneau plays at 1 o'clock and 7 o'clock each day, Saturday and Sunday. There are
Friday
10
and Saturday.
Friday and Saturday. There are 10 games Friday and another 10 on Saturday. And on Sunday, there are two semifinal games in the morning and a championship game in the afternoon. So as Matt said, Juneau will play at 1 o'clock and at 7 o'clock each day, Friday and Saturday.
And if the last time you went to the ice rink, they had aluminum bleachers. They've got wooden ones now, so it's not as cold on your bottom.
Correct.
That's right.
And heaters
above to keep you warm.
Yeah.
Anything you'd like to end? I might have forgotten to ask.
Yeah, we just really wanted to send a special thanks to Holland America, CBJ Parks and Rec. I wanted to thank the tournament committee and the director, Tiffany Davis, for all the hard work that they've put in over the last several months of really getting this together. And we're really looking forward to a good and hard-fought tournament.
This is going to be a very fun weekend.
Thanks to Matt Boleyn and Steve Quinn for coming down.
All right, thank you.
Minutes past the hour, and you are tuned in to KTUO News in Juneau and Caronin, FM in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Next guest is Laura Baker. She's here to talk to us about the home show, which is coming up this weekend. Laura, thank you for coming up to the station today.
Thank you.
So, home show is put on by the Southeast Alaska Building Industry
Association, that's correct. The CBA is a nonprofit, and this is one of our ways of sharing with the community and getting, you know, knowledge, educating the community on what the services and whatnot are in town, and it's also a fundraiser for our organization.
And it's been going on for how many years?
This is our 36th show.
Wow.
It's a long time, yeah.
What's different about this show from other years?
Well, we try to add a few things. We have a design build contest where we had some of our members sign up to build something out of repurposed or leftover materials, and we'll have a silent auction on those items and voting. That'll happen at Friday night's event and during Saturday, so somebody could take one of those items home with them on Sunday if they win. We're going to have a Pinewood Derby. The Scouts are letting us set up the track, and we've opened up the registration to the public. We still have some slots open if people are still interested, and that race will be on Sunday from noon to 1:30.
How many businesses take part in the home show?
This year we have just over 50. We've had more in the past, but we have a lot of new vendors coming in this year, and a lot of our returning vendors as well.
What are some of the new vendors?
Well, we have some folks from Canada coming down. You caught me off guard on that one. I don't have my full list in front of me.
We got a lot of people taking part in it, and just in general.
We do. It's a great event, and the Friday night event that happens annually, the wine and beer tasting event, the catered event, people enjoy coming to that. It's more of a leisurely atmosphere to visit the vendors, talk about their services, what they might be supplying, and some of our builders. And that's from 5 to 8 on Friday night. Folks can still get advanced tickets for $20, or it's $25 at the door, and you must be 21 to enter that.
Who's a typical audience member of the home show?
I would say people that are homeowners or first-time buyers or people that, people looking to remodel or building a new home. Maybe they want to spruce up something they have.
And you have seminars going on during the weekend?
We do. We have 7 seminars this year with some really jazzy titles. And we'd love to have people join those. Again, you can get in on Saturday and Sunday for general admission of $6 and sit in on any of these free seminars. One of them is a low to no cost steps to a healthier home and family. We have a round table of ask the experts, a realtor and a lender, builder, energy specialist, and one of the CBJ reps from the building department. And they'll answer questions, just kind of an open forum. We also have somebody putting on a learn about the wonderful world of paint, to kind of talk about some of the paint options out there. And then, is your home stuck in the 70s? You know, a lot of the houses in Juneau were built in the 70s and 80s, and so it might be time to do something different and maybe need some funding to do that, or just, you know, what other things can you do? What about lead-based paint? That kind of goes back to, we have a lot of older homes in Juneau, too, that we need to watch out for paint. And insulation. They can learn about insulation and whether what they have is keeping their house warm and what the options are now if they wanted to do something different. And then a dirty lowdown fact on mold in your home. Obviously, in Juneau, being in a wet environment, you can get mold in the house. If you had wood-framed windows, you're more susceptible to having moisture and mold than you might if you have fiberglass surround on your windows.
About how many people attend the home show?
I'd say about 1,400 throughout the weekend.
What a festive atmosphere, too.
Pardon?
A festive atmosphere.
It is a festive atmosphere. And like I say, Friday night we have the special event, and Saturday we'll be very active with the silent auction going on, and then Sunday we're going to liven it up a bit with the Pinewood Derby from noon to 1:30. Going to bring the family day in, bring the kids in, see what we can do with those race cars. We have scouts, we have vendors, we have just people have signed up for it just to have some fun, be a kid again.
And the hours again?
Friday night is 5 to 8, Saturday is 10 to 5, and Sunday is 11 to 4.
And what does it cost to get in?
$6 on Saturday and Sunday, and Friday night is $25 at the door. They could still get advance tickets if they give us a call. 463-5774.
Well, Bruce, anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
I just think it's exciting for people to be able to come to one location to see all the vendors and, you know, and figure out what they can do with the home they have, or if they want to buy a home. What are the options? Just come visit us all under one roof and see us. We'll also, CB will have a booth. We can let folks know, you know, what we do with our organization and our members as well. And I'd like to thank our sponsor, First Bank. They're sponsoring the home show. We have a number of sponsors that are sponsoring the Friday night event as well. Alaska Renovators, Alaska Escrow Title and Insurance Company. I'm going to go blank here for a minute. We have Mendenhall Auto, who is sponsoring our derby on Sunday. And we have Alaska USA Mortgage Company, who's also a sponsor for Friday night. And Southeast Furniture Warehouse. Come sit in some great furniture.
All right. Thanks again for coming by, Laura.
Thank you very much.
Once upon a time, there were 3 little pigs. One day, they were old enough to each have a house of their own. But their mother warned them to build their houses strong. so they would be safe from the big bad wolf. Now the first little pig was lazy, so when he built his house, this is what happened. The first little pig built his house of straw. He ran inside when the wolf he saw. Little pig, little pig, let me come in. Not by the hair of my chinny chin chin. So he huffed and he puffed and he huffed and he blew the house in. Well, the first little pig ran off as fast as he could to hide from the big bad wolf. Now the second little pig didn't like to work either. So when he built his house, what do you think happened? The second little pig built his house of sticks. The wolf came a-knocking just for kicks. Little pig, little pig, let me go. Little pig ran off into the forest as fast as his little feet would go. Now the third little pig remembered what his mother told him, so he built his house strong and safe. The third little pig built his house of brick. The wolf came along and ran inside quick. Little pig, little pig, let me go. Was awful bad. He jumped on the house top. He was really mad. Little pig, down the chimney I go. But the little pig had a boiling pot of water below. Oh, look at him go.
Greg and Steve, it's 28 minutes past the hour. You are tuned in to Juno Afternoon. Next guests are here to talk about Mudrooms events going on tomorrow night at Northern Light Church. Dave Griffin and Amanda Compton, thank you for coming down to the station.
Thanks for having us, Jeff.
So for people who don't know what Mudrooms is, a quick overview, please, Amanda.
Quick overview is at 7 o'clock, we will be congregating at the Northern Light United Church. There will be seven people who have rehearsed a story that is 7 minutes on the theme, Brush with the Law, and live music.
How did you pick out the Brush with the Law theme?
We have a board of seven people. We get together in the spring, and we decide on the themes for the next season. So in April, seven of us got together and went through a bunch of them. It's pretty fun. People pitch us ideas, so we try and find ones that might allow people to have some parameters and focus in on a particular story that will they'll remember, oh, that's a good story, or that will just be wide enough to allow them to figure out how to tell that one story they've been waiting to tell.
When they tell the stories, they permitted notes, but they discouraged use of notes?
We have no hard and fast rules. We don't throw people off the stage at 7 minutes, nor will we beat them if they have notes. That said, we just discourage them because some of the more powerful stories are the ones that are just coming out of the person. They're resonating out of the person. They're able to have a little bit of structure that they've memorized, but they're putting the flesh to it ad lib.
What makes for a good story?
That's why I brought Pete, actually. He's sitting right here. Maybe you could introduce yourself, Pete. You've got some experience with this.
It's some experience in storytelling. A good story requires a protagonist, you know, a hero of the story, and facing a conflict. And usually in the resolution of that conflict or problem solving, the hero learns something or is changed by the events, and that encapsulates what a good story is of somebody facing a problem and how they get through that problem.
And to tell one live on stage is interesting too. Some stories are very intricate and complicated and have a very powerful take-home message, and some stories are very simple. And the ones that seem to go over the best, or people really are, the crowd is interacting well, or interacting probably isn't the right word, they're responding well, can be the simpler ones where you can really work and flesh out a smaller story without trying to cram too many details in there.
It seems like the stories are stories that people have told for years and years informally during dinner parties or cocktail parties.
Yeah, we get a lot of those. We have a lot of stories that people will mention. I mean, our first speaker tomorrow is someone who was telling me this story at a bar, and I suggested this open spot that we had in March, and he's stepping up and taking it. So it's exactly how it works. And then, you know, they grow. The stories grow themselves when they're getting feedback from the audience and they're in front of 250 people. So that's what happens.
Do you offer tellers any hints as to how they might be able to tell a story the best way?
We offer resources. We have Tom Cosgrove on our storyboard who can check in with people. We offer our services, our ears, whatever it is. We'll be there to help coach you. But right now we don't have a list of pointers. I ask people, I just ask people to check in with me if they're having a problem. But we don't have a list of pointers or anything like that.
Matthew, you're an accomplished storyteller and a couple CDs of stories out.
Yes.
What kind of advice would you give people who are telling stories in the rooms?
I think they're all personal stories, so I think a person needs to come from an authentic place. So they really need to let their emotions go and be vulnerable in telling a story. That's important. And the other thing is to try to memorize a story. I think memorizing the mileposts, so here I was then, there I was a while later, and then here was the end, that's fine.
That's a good pointer.
Yeah, but not to memorize, because if you lose your place when you memorize something, you don't know where to go. So that's the big thing. So it means for folks stumbling too, but that's okay. This is a really forgiving and a supportive audience, and the audience eats that up. If you're really authentic in telling the story, folks really go for it.
And he brought up the word vulnerable or vulnerability, and I think that is some of the draw of Mudrooms, is that people are willing to make themselves vulnerable in front of other people. It allows other people to connect with them that way. I could expand on that more, but I think that's enough.
No, please.
Really?
No, vulnerability is a strength. Folks might think it's a weakness, but it's really a strength when you can stand in front of folks and say, boy, here's a mistake I made a long time ago. I learned from it, but this is a mistake that I did make.
And exposing yourself personally. I think there's so many people that are there. There's bound to be a percentage of them with which something resonates. And so if you make yourself vulnerable, you are making yourself more approachable to a wider group of people. And there will be that deeper or different level of connection that you're making with them.
Have the stories or the tellers gotten any better over the course of the years that you're in your fourth season now?
No, because I wouldn't ever use the word better. I think some stories are more well-rehearsed. Some stories go over better, but I don't think the actual story or storyteller is ever better than someone else. It's such a mixed bag from a laundry list of things someone's dad did to them to a very developed, these are some life lessons, stories my grandfather told me, to I ran into a bear out on this particular island and this is what happened. And they're so different. I don't think I would say one's better than the other. The thing that's developed is that we've had more people come forward, and so we're at the point that We don't have to solicit, although we choose to, because we don't want to rely exclusively on people coming forward to volunteer. We still want to get those people that are telling the story at the bar, at the dinner table, and we say, wow, it would be really fun. It would be really great to hear you tell that to a bigger audience.
If the tellers may or may not have learned anything, what has the board learned about the whole process?
The board is currently learning. It's I think we're having to do more learning this season. Since we donate 100% of our profits to charity, we have people stepping up saying, hey, can we have some of the money next year or be considered? And so now instead of getting together and talking to people in the community about what nonprofits might be good to donate to, we have people coming to us. We're being pulled in more directions, which is a positive outcome because we have so much support and success. The high schools have gotten together, and they're going to have their first mudrooms, our own type storytelling event in the spring, which we'll be talking about later. And they'll be there at the event tomorrow, too, to help us set up, et cetera. So our board is learning that there are decisions we have to navigate as a group, and everyone brings a really unique set of skills to our particular board, and it's important to draw off all of those and make collective decisions.
The stories are recorded and broadcast on KTUO on the fourth Thursday of the month at 7 o'clock.
They sure are, thanks to you, Jeff.
Well, thanks to people like Rich Moniak and Steve Swain.
Yes, Jeff. Yes, they are. People tune in at 7 p.m. the last Thursday of the month, and they can listen to a compiled show with some of the music. Since we feature live musicians every month, we'll put that in the background. And it's a really great way to tune in to listen again to a story, or just if you missed them, to listen. Yeah, it's great.
Now, you got the initial inspiration for producing Mudrooms from the series that was going on in Anchorage, which in turn got its... starts from watching a porch.
Yeah, from a Baltimore series. The Anchorage was a spinoff of a Baltimore series called Stoops, where the sister organization of Arctic Entry is. And if you get a chance while you're in Anchorage, it's a much different show. They used to be in the Cyrano's Playhouse, off-center Playhouse. Can't recall what it's called, but it was just, you know, less people coming than we had at our pilot, and now they're in the Performing Arts Center, and you have to get tickets as soon as they go on sale. But I would recommend going if you're up there for it.
Do you have a good time when you're up there, Pete?
Oh, when I'm up in front of folks telling a story? You bet. It is just a blast being in front of an audience, a live audience, telling a story. The feedback that you get from the audience, the story changes shape a little bit. When you're reacting to an audience and the audience is reacting to you, that is the thing about live storytelling that you don't get from a CD or watching on television or something. A storyteller craves live audiences, and this is just a wonderful event, and I really, really enjoy it.
So if you're in the habit of marking your calendar for things to do, tomorrow night's Mudrooms is at 7 o'clock at Northern Light Church.
It is. It's at the Northern Light United Church at 7 o'clock. We ask people to get there early because it can take a while to get into the door because everyone comes at once, and we start promptly at 7. If you do come tomorrow, you'll get to hear stories on Brush with the Law by Gene Nelson, Pete, who's sitting with me here today, Rory Watt, his mother Pat Watt, Mitch Jackson, Kristen Crandonk, and Brandon Demery, with music by Dan Edwards.
And it's cost $7 to get in, and it all goes to a charity.
It does. It will be benefiting SAIL tomorrow night and the rest of the season, and we'll have cookies and coffee, too.
All right. Anything you'd like to add that I've forgotten to ask?
You can always go to mudrooms.org to see hear archived stories, see the next event, the schedule, find our email if you want to pitch us either a charity or a theme for an upcoming season, too.
Next April is not the first week of the month. It's changed to the 14th.
This is correct. Usually Folk Fest, the Alaska Folk Festival, was usually the second week in April, which is when we have our event. So we would always have ours the first week of April. Now the Folk Festival is having theirs the first week of April, so we are moving ours to the second.
That's nice of you.
I'd like to think so.
Ben Compton and Pete Griffin, thank you very much for coming on the station today.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks for having us, Jeff.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 10th of March, 2015. It's the birthday of the jazz cornetist Bix Beiderbecke, born Davenport, Iowa, 1903. It's the birthday of the playwright and novelist David Raby, born in Dubuque, Iowa, 1940. He was drafted, sent to Vietnam, worked in a hospital unit, did paperwork there. He wrote about being in Vietnam, barriers were down, restrictions were down, behavior outside the norms. There was this giddy thing. You could go around one corner and see something horrible, around another and see something thrilling. It was a little like the Wild West. He came back and wrote a trilogy of plays about Vietnam, The Basic Training of Pablo Hummel, Sticks and Bones, and Streamers. His most recent work is the play An Early History of Fire. David Raby, who said, "I get a sentence, an idea, an image, and I start. I don't know anything beyond it. I follow it." It was on this day, 1876, Alexander Graham Bell made the first successful telephone call using a liquid transmitter, a diaphragm, that caused a needle to vibrate in water. He spoke to his assistant, Thomas Watson, in the next room and said, "Mr. Watson, come here. I want to see you." It was on this day, 1926, the first Book of the Month Club book was published. It was Lolly Willows, or The Loving Huntsman, by Sylvia Townsend Warner. When the club started out, 1926, they had 4,000 subscribers. They grew to 550,000 by 1946 and peaked in 1988 with 1.5 million subscribers. And then the Internet came along, and the big chain bookstores spelled the eventual decline of the Book of the Month Club. Here's a poem for today by Jeffrey Harrison entitled A Drink of Water. When my 19-year-old son turns on the kitchen tap and leans down over the sink and tilts his head sideways to drink directly from the stream of cool water, I think of my older brother, now almost 10 years gone, who used to do the same thing at that age. And when he lifts his head back up and satisfied wipes the water dripping from his cheek with his shirt sleeve, it's the same casual gesture my brother used to make. And I don't tell him to use a glass the way our father told my brother, because I like remembering my brother when he was young, decades before anything went wrong. And I like the way my son becomes a little more my brother for a moment through this small habit born of a simple need, which natural and unprompted ties them together across the bounds of death and across time, as if the clear stream flowed between two worlds and entered this one through the kitchen faucet, my son and brother drinking the same water. A poem by Jeffrey Harrison, A Drink of Water, from his collection Into Daylight, published by Tupelo Press and used by permission here on The Writer's Almanac, supported by Progressive Insurance with its APRON project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen. And by Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. Learn more at lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's about 15 minutes before the hour, and you are tuned to KRNN FM in Juneau and KTOO FM in Juneau. Today we have Glacier Valley Principal Lucy Potter and teacher Hans Chester to talk about a new Tlingit language and missions class at Glacier Valley. The program is in partnership with Gold Belt. Lucy and Hans, thank you very much for coming down to the station.
Sure, our pleasure.
Hans, you want to start it up by giving us an overview of the program?
Sure thing. So in January, we started this program, I guess it is, of delivering Tlingit language instruction to small groups through enrichment. And so I service about 50 students four times a week by grade level, and I deliver Tlingit language instruction using literacy, stories, and song.
Is it just for natives?
No, it's actually a school-wide thing that we're putting forth right now. So for now, I'm working with small enrichment groups, like I said, four times a week, and I also am going into classrooms to deliver whole group instruction.
You concentrate a lot on oral storytelling.
I do some, yes. It's quite an equal balance between literacy-based instruction and oral language.
What about the use of songs?
That's a little more spontaneous. Sometimes kids will come in singing or humming a song, and so I kind of feed into that spirit. And one day a child walked in and he saw a drum, so he just picked it up and started singing a song. So we spent 5 minutes singing a song, and that led into another one. And after that, the drum got put away, and we went forth with our language lesson. So that the song part's a little more spontaneous. And with the younger students, I'm doing a lot of total physical response, and like saying touch your head and touch your hand, and then we'll go into head, shoulders, knees, and toes and Tlingit.
That's a neat song.
It's absolutely engaging.
What age is it for?
It's for kindergarten through fifth grades, so all grade levels in Glacier Valley.
You use the elders in your program?
Oh, yes. Elders come in periodically. We have Florence Mark Shakely Kakathot. She's the one who taught me to speak Tlingit. She comes in twice a week, and she works with students and with myself. So it's really beneficial to have her there. I'm really thankful that she's able to come in. And then Marge Dudson is another one who's been in a couple of times, and Shawnee is her Tlingit name. And she gets to work with kids too. And one of the things that sticks out in my mind is how she interacted with students on the iPads, learning different words and seeing that interaction between a first grader and an elder was really, really golden. That was awesome.
It seems interesting to use such a new technology as an iPad when you're talking about a language that's been around for thousands of years.
Yeah, it is. And it's a real hook to get kids to go through the lesson that I have planned so that they can then go onto the iPad. And oftentimes they're learning things that I didn't even think that I would try to teach them. But since the technology is right there at their fingertips, they can access it. And then that then opens up another possibility for learning.
Why is it important? I'll ask you, Hans, and also Lucy, you can mention Chapman if you want to.
I'm sorry, why is it important?
Mm-hmm.
Well, one thing that we're doing is we're keeping really, really close data on the students and their learning and their language acquisition as we're moving through the program. And if you look at the research, language learning a second language helps with brain development. So I think that that's one reason why it's important. It's also important that we live in Southeast Alaska, and the Tlingit culture is very prevalent in Southeast Alaska, and I think it's important for all kids to learn about the culture that's around us.
Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly, and that giving this opportunity to all students in our school is going to help push this movement even further forward than it's been pushed already. And for me, it's really important because I grew up going to Glacier Valley, and we had, in grade levels, we had a two-week period of time where Indian studies curriculum was taught to us. And so looking back on my own education, it's really awesome to see how much growth has been made between the time I was a student at Glacier Valley and now where I'm teaching language on a daily basis. So that is very important to me, that there's exposure, there's lots of repetition, and that students are gaining something that is useful.
UCUA students in the course of your work?
Yeah, there are a couple of students who, they also do some work with Gold Belt Heritage, but they're also students out at UAS, and Une Lance Twitchell has done a real good job of grooming these students to read and write and to use those skills of reading and writing to acquire more language for themselves. And Heather Burge and Mallory Story are the two students who've been coming in so far. And they help me out as they can. Sometimes they'll help with a gesture or a movement that will allow the kids to process the language that was said. So if there's some kind of movement or kinesthetic that can be attached to the language, then that's beneficial, so understanding can happen. And some of those UAS students are way beyond me in regards to knowing some sign or using gestures to convey meaning. So that's extremely helpful for me.
I wonder if you could talk just a little bit more about the Tlingit literacy assessments.
Sure. And actually, both of us can talk about this. It's actually something, the literary assessments that we have are based on some of the assessments that we use already just for teaching reading in English. And Hans has taken those assessments and created actual assessments for language acquisition, Tlingit language acquisition. So he's taken the same tools that we've used for teaching reading in English and translated them so that they are working for the Tlingit language. So that's, I don't know if people are familiar with, but the phonics screener that we use to check on phonics skills for new readers, we're using that same tool in for the Tlingit language. So,
yeah, our alphabet is a phonemically accurate alphabet. So one group of letters and markings equals one sound. And that cueing into a phonics skill is going to allow, and learning those skills allows learners to become more proficient with what they're reading because there's only one way to say that sound. So with the assessment, what I tried to do was use English's model as just the progression of how sounds are taught and what sounds are more frequent in English. I tried to apply that as best as I could to Tlingit because I know that this assessment is very informative to our instruction. And if we could replicate this with students who are learning Tlingit across the region, then we're going to raise the bar, so to speak, with our language and who's learning the language and how many people can say a few phrases. And then that can snowball into learning how to converse.
What kind of resources do you use? I know a while back I was working on a Tlingit book about garbage bears.
Yes. Ernestine's book is one that kind of talks into the city bear and the town bear. But that's something that I'm trying to lead up towards is a book such as that where it's all in Tlingit. But some of the resources I use have been developed, you know, decades ago. And the Downhauer's books, Beginning Tlingit and the Intermediate Draft. We have the Noun Dictionary. We have the Interior Dictionary that Jeff Lear put together. There are all of the units that Sea Alaska Heritage Institute has disseminated out to schools. Some of those lessons I use. And then Gold Belt Heritage has also been working with language learners and teachers so that they can develop units that are then useful for people throughout Southeast or wherever it is they want to learn Tlingit.
You can measure success academically, but what other kinds of ways can you measure success in your program?
Well, I am blinded each day by students' knowledge and the way it comes out or how a student might see one of the elders and interact with that elder right then and there without any prompt. It just, that right there is a huge measure of their ability to internalize what's being taught to them and for it to come out on their own. That's one of the goals of doing this, is to get people conversing with each other. So on the spot is one of the most rewarding, but it's also one of the hardest to track.
I'm talking with Hans Chester, who's a teacher, and Glacier Valley Principal Lucy Potter. What do you see as the future of this program, Lucy?
We're hoping that it can continue. We still are solidifying our funding resources and hoping that the program will continue to get funded. Right now it's on a kind of a monitoring status. So we're hoping to pull in some funding so that we can continue the program from lots of different areas, funding from lots of different areas. So we're hoping that we can continue it and we can build Clinkit speakers. He's working with kindergarten students now, and we'll be monitoring and kind of keeping data, and hopefully those kids will continue up through, you know, through fifth grade and kind of see where we go from there. And, you know, I know that the goal for us is that we are producing Clinkit speakers that can spread that word to others. So
I second that, and I would just like also, not just within our own student population, but within families and homes, that the students who are with us right now learning Clinkit can then share that and have it go outside of just our Glacier Valley community.
Yeah, the other piece to that too is we're trying to get this program going, and once it gets going and we have the materials and the data and the assessments and all the pieces in place, we're hoping that we could also spread this program to other schools.
Absolutely.
That's kind of what our goal is, so that all elementary schools could possibly have a program like we have.
All right, Hans Chester and Lucy Potter, thank you very much for coming down to the station. Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
Contact Glacier Valley if you would like to help our Glacier Valley Clinkit dancers attend the Hoonah School Potlatch in April. We're raising money now to go over on a catamaran on April 17th. Contact Glacier Valley if you'd like to help us get to Hoonah.
All right, thanks very much for coming down.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on a junior afternoon, Jamie Waste will be your host. Kevin Miller of Tonkus Turners will be here to highlight the art of creating functional art with wood. Bob Armstrong and Doug Jones will be here with a preview of this month's Audubon presentation. And Margie Hamburger will be here with the update activities of the Junior Listening City Museum. For the forecast for tonight, partly cloudy skies, colder weather, low temperatures 18 to 24 degrees above zero. Forecast for Wednesday, increasing clouds with a chance of snow in the afternoon. Wednesday night, chance of snow and cloudy skies. Thursday, rain and snow expected with high temperatures around 40 degrees.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown.